Welcome to Hallel Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. Sacrifice, provision, and redemption intertwine in Genesis 22 and parallel passages in Isaiah 33 and Matthew 27. From the binding of Isaac to the ultimate sacrifice of the Messiah, these scriptures show us a tapestry of faith and trust and the transformative power of trials. We learn how to discern the unseen workings of heaven, respond to the call and embrace divine shalom, or contentment, amidst the chaos around us. This study invites us to cultivate vision, endurance, and a deeper understanding of the God who sees, provides, and redeems. May we be ready to answer the summons of heaven the way Abraham and Isaac did, Hineni, which is Hebrew for Here I Am.
The one thread that really works through all of these passages relates to sacrifice. When will it be given, actually? Will you actually give something of yourself that is really dear and is something that you don't want to part with? Divine provision. Will you actually see it when it is given to you? Or will you mistake it for something else or just not be able to see it at all? And also, redemption. Will we actually accept it when it's provided? When we are being saved, will we actually fight against the one saving us or actually decide that's something that we don't want to have? Amazingly enough, people actually do fight those that are trying to save them because they maybe don't even realize that they are being saved. I know that's one of the things that when they were taking life-saving classes, when you're out swimming, that people, when they're facing a potentially life-threatening situation, will panic and will just lash out at the person trying to save them. And you end up having to fight off the person you're trying to help in the midst of trying to save them. So one of the kind of the key takeaways of the passage there, Genesis 22, is this is what's called the Akedah, or the binding of Isaac passage, is where Genesis 22 starts out with. And that's where, you know, Abraham is commanded to offer Yitzhak, his one and only son, as a sacrifice. But God provides or reveals a ram instead, a substitution for it. And that's one of the key threads that goes through all these passages. Is it providing or revealing? And when you look in the under the hood into the Hebrew word, it's the same word. It's really on its face means to see, but it also is can be translated as to be provided or be revealed. So that's one of the things you saw in our prophet's reading there is, can you actually see it? You're claiming you can see, but can you actually see? You're claiming you can hear, but can you actually hear? And it was a strange thing that we saw in that prophet's passage that we'll be getting to a little bit more, because it seems like that heaven doesn't want you to see or doesn't want you to hear, because why? Otherwise, you would turn and return to the Lord and be saved. But one of the things we see with this picture of vision is it's a vision for those who actually want to see. So like with Elroy, or as we saw back in Genesis 16, you know, the phrase is Ata Elroy, or one way that could be translated is, you are God who sees me. You are God who sees me. So that's Hagar with Ishmael is going out into the land. She is saying to the angel of the Lord, you are El Roy. You are God who sees me. You see where I'm at in my situation. That's something we've been seeing repeatedly throughout these encounters that we've seen so far in the book of Bereshit or Genesis, that this is the creator of heaven and earth, is the one who actually sees what is going on, not oblivious to the plight that we face in life. Sees what our current situations are. So then, we have the instruction from the master when he says, so the master does, so what do the disciples or the students do? What should they do as well? The master is the one who sees everything, sees what the conditions are of everybody. What should the servants of the master do? What should the students of the master do? See the plights and the conditions of those people going around you. So thus, we see one of the instructions that comes out of that idea, that continually reinforced message is, we call that the golden rule. They're found in Leviticus 19:18. It's, do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. Why? Because just as God has done for us, so we do for other people. Because the creator of heaven and earth saw our plight, saw our situation. So thus, because he has seen our plight and heard us, so then we see the plight of other people around us and we hear their plight as well. And so that becomes a part of our mission as well. Because just as heaven does, so the people of heaven do as well with all around us. So this El Roy, the God who sees me, or the one who sees, the God who sees, he appears to Abraham and reveals what heaven will do through Abraham's zerah, or his seed. So one of the things that people always ask, why did God command Abraham to offer his son? Remember we always talk about with the punchlines, with the parables? The parable is not this and that and the details of this and, the, and that and the other. It is what? The punchline. The punchline of the Akedah is Adonai Yireh. That is the punchline. The Lord will see, or the Lord will be seen. That is the punchline of the Akedah, of the binding of Isaac, the offering of Isaac, the call to offer him. That is the whole point, that the Lord will be seen in what is going on here, and that the Lord does see what is going on in the situation, is not completely oblivious to that. And thus, with the Akedah, is now a foreshadowing, something pointing forward to an ultimate sign of what God is doing and the ultimate sacrifice with Yeshua. Heaven's, you know, we have it in the Akedah, one and only Son. We have it there in the Gospels, the calling of the one and only one of heaven, that God's provision. And just like with the Akedah, this would be a testing and a strengthening of the trust that people of God have in heaven, that this is something that God is actually doing. And we saw that with the passages we saw from Matthew here today. That is the zerah, the seed of the woman, the seed that comes through Abraham, truly the one who comes in the name of the Lord, that we can truly say, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord? Or do we say, no, this is not the one who comes in the name of the Lord? So in the other passage that we have here in Isaiah 33, it's something that's speaking of judgment, of salvation, of actually saving someone from a situation to a, you could say, a better situation, one where you're not dying, being under subjugation of some other power, etc. Subjugation of a power of your own making upon yourself. We think of salvation in some highfalutin theological terms, but salvation biblically is you are in a jam, heaven is taking you out of that jam, out of the mess, taking you out of the bondage, the subjugation to shalom, to place where you are content, everything is well, You are not worrying about anything. Now, you can be in shalom or contentment, peace, but everything around you can be chaos. That is a whole part of what you say of entering his rest. Because when Israel went into the land, into the rest of God, did that solve all the world's problems? No. The world was still chaos all around. And even inside of Israel, as we had seen in some of the other passages we looked at today. It was still chaos swirling around Israel. But what was there to be a sign of? It was to be a witness for all the nations that, just like someone in the midst of muck and mire, you can reach out and say, you don't have to live like this. So Israel was to be a beacon to the world and say to the world, you don't have to live like this. You don't have to be slave to your so-called deities, which enslave you, that you were driven to serve them. Even in some of the cults, you hand over your children to them physically through violent means. You hand them over with all of these attempts at what? Gaining favor for your crops, gaining favor for your town, gaining favor for your business, fertility, prosperity, not suffering under some sort of calamity of weather, etc. But this passage here in Isaiah 33 is also telling us about the fear and the suffering of the people. It also is mirroring the kind of terror that you see with Yitzhak on the altar. Even though he's saying, here am I, when his father said to him, he said, here I am. And the realization was there about what was actually going forward. He still went forward with it. And that gets amped up even more when you get down to the ultimate offering of the son, the only son there with the Messiah. Okay, so that's one of the high views of this. And when we get down to our passage in Matthew, that we have like Yitzhak, this would be a willing sacrifice in the end, but it would be something that would go forward and not be spared from it. Because ultimately, that ram, that say as it is there in Hebrew, would be provided. But in this case, it would be the Messiah himself. That would be heaven's say that's provided, heaven's ram. All right, well, looking into this a little bit further with the passage there in Genesis 22. So we were saying earlier today, the theme for today is hineni, which is the Hebrew word that means here I am, hineni. That means I'm stepping up. Here I am to be summoned, to be directed, to take action. That is a response that you have of, I am hearing and I will do. So we always talk about Shema. Okay, great. Shema encapsulated is that, is not to, okay, yeah, you hear something, some sound waves are going into your head, they're bouncing on your tympanic membrane, something may get into your skull as some sort of message going on there, but then as the aphorism goes, in your one ear and out the other ear, but it doesn't actually go into your brain and become a part of you and something that you actually are changed as a part of that. With the response of something, you hear it, but then you're responding, hineni, or here I am. That's a stepping up message of, okay, this message is coming, and I'm going to respond and act to it. So with each of us, we can have our hineni moments any time of the day, and they come all kinds of times where somebody needs something and it becomes obvious somebody needs help. And you're stepped up at that moment and just saying, are we going to say hineni or have somebody else do it? Have somebody else take care of it. So as we move on a little bit further and take a look at this heaven's call, how do we respond? Well, Avraham responded to the call of heaven and of those around him. Because first, you see that Avraham called, hineni. He responded, now go take your son, your only son, and now go offer him the promised son that he was praying a long time for there on the mountain. But it also says that Ha'elohim nisa et Avraham, that God tested Abraham there. Now, when we see the word test, we can think, well, it's like, oh, it's an exam. You're supposed to take an exam. And if you pass the exam, then maybe heaven's grading on a curve. Maybe he's grading on a curve, and then, you know, if we don't screw up enough, then maybe we'll slide by. We'll make it onto the bell curve side of it, and we'll actually pass the exam. But the Bible doesn't use those terms related to test that way, and we'll see more of that as we go along. But some ancient commentators have seen an interesting connection there between the Hebrew words, just by the way that they're spelled, because nisa is, you have, you know, nun, samach, and hey. And another word that's very prominent is nes. And nes is nun, samach. And nes is a word that you see show up a lot that means like a sign or an emblem of it. And we'll see some examples of it as we go on. There's kind of two words that you see a lot in the Bible that we'll refer to as a sign. One is ot, which is a variation of that usually untranslated word in Hebrew. We have et, which is aleph and tav. Ot is like a sign. Oh, there it is. Usually, et is not translated. It just says, hey, here's the direct object of your sentence. But with ot is saying, hey, you should pay attention to this, because this is a sign, an indicator of something that is happening. But a lot of people have seen over the hundreds of years that this nes, or a signal pole, a standard, an ensign, a banner, a sign, or a sail, are different ways that that's translated throughout the Bible. That some have seen that in this the Midrashim, or the commentaries that have come over the centuries about this, that this could also be understood to mean God exalted Abraham. That he exalted him to, in the sense that a banner flies above an army or a ship for identification. And God exalted him by giving him a test, which proved his utter faithfulness. And as we'll see going along, that is part of what a better translation of nisa, or test, is in this particular case. And a lot of times you see throughout the Bible. And we'll see that as we go along, why that is a message that heaven is trying to get across to us. Something that is examined to see its strength and actually to make it stronger. For example, we have it at Rephidim that we see there in Exodus 17, a part of the Exodus. So in the Exodus 17, this is after the Red Sea crossing. They've gone up the other side. Exodus 16 was about what? Manna, that stuff that just shows up. Your daily bread shows up 6 days a week. And that's a sign of God's faithfulness, of provision, providing it. You go out, and you see, hey, it's there. Okay, so it's there. Great. You just kind of mark a note. Hey, there's food out there. All right. No. The point is, you go out, you see the food. What then is your job? To go get the food. and to go out and look for it. Look for it each there and each morning. And when you see it, you go collect it. But then there was also another part of the instruction. On the Shabbat, you're not to go out to go look for it. Because why? It won't be there. So, but if you go out the day before and look for it, what will you find? Twice as much. So that you collect twice as much. Because if you tried to hoard it, it wouldn't last and it would rot. Supernaturally, it would just rot because food doesn't normally rot that incredibly fast. So with this particular situation, and you move on even further, so after the Red Sea crossing, after the manna, then you enter a place where they run out of water. Okay, so here, coming up out of the Red Sea, you're hungry. We have no food. We have no bread. Bingo. The Lord sends bread and says, go out, look for it. You find it, collect it. Use it. Then there's no water. As we've talked about before, you can go quite a long time, almost up to a month without food. It'll get pretty tough on you, but you can go up to a month without food. But how many days can you really go without water? Supposedly three. But, you know, we do the Yom Kippur fast and just one seems like quite a challenge sometimes. But yeah, up to three. So you start running out of water. So the one who provided the deliverance from slavery in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, the one who provided the escape from the Egyptian army, the one who provided a way through the sea, the one who provided the daily bread. Now you need water. What should you expect by that point? Water. If you need water and you're saying, hey, we need water, you've seen the provisions there so far. You've seen water. You should be seeing water then. Well, after this point of actually getting water, then you have where the account we have in Exodus 17, where you encounter not just the provision of water, where there was no water, then suddenly Amalek is attacking. This force that doesn't like to attack your strongest forces, it likes to come and do rear actions, but not just rear actions against your army, rear actions against people who are defenseless, who really cannot fight. That is a force that's coming up towards your heels, which is very interesting that you have this message that goes all the way back to the garden, that the Nahash or the snake, the serpent, would be bruising the heel of the seed of the woman. And that bruising the heel, that's an idiom that shows up a lot. The attacking of the heel is something that shows up a lot in scripture for attacking your most vulnerable parts. So doing an action towards your rear or grabbing you by the ankle. And one of the earliest accounts that the linguists will find of that is after just what you find in Genesis, is there in Job where it talks about that he grabbed you by the yakav or the heel and ensnared you. So that idea of being attacked at the heel is something that comes in with subterfuge, with cunning, and comes in and attacks you to try to, because what happens if you are not able to move around on your feet? If you're tethered and you need to run or you need to fight your way out of a situation and you're tethered by one of your appendages, what? You need to start encountering some real problems, right? So with this attack, that comes with Amalek. So you've seen, Israel has seen provision. Deliverance, food, daily bread, Now water. Now with Amalek, one of the things that's provided and given this message that there would be a deliverance that was given for the attack at the rear, attack at the heel of Amalek, this force that just keeps attacking, swarming in to get at your weak points, to get you down, to destroy. We have Purim coming up here, the festival of lots from the book of Esther. And what we know that's just mentioned about the genealogy of Haman or Haman, we know that he's a descendant of whom? Yes, the Amalekites, specifically from Agag. So because of the Amalekites, Amalek was not dealt with earlier on in Israel's history, left to fester. So thus it attacked at the heel yet again, hundreds of years later. But at that victory where during the Exodus, that God gives the victory over Amalek, as long as what? Moshe keeps his arms up. And thus he had one on each side, a person on each side of him holding his arms up. And as his arms were lifted up, thus there was given the victory. So you have this picture in the scene of Moshe there with his arms up, and as long as Moshe's arms are up, there is given the victory. So throughout time, there's been with military officers have always been there as a sign, a show for their troops to see, okay, if the leadership is still in the fight and is still leading and is still there, then we as a force still have hope. We still have hope that we're going to have the victory and move through this. But if you see your sign of leadership there get destroyed or killed in the battle, your banner falls over, what then often happens? You see records of this throughout various times of warfare, various armies. It's a similar thing. They run. They start losing hope because your banners, your leadership are there to do what? To rally the people, to say, hey, we are still watching over this situation and you still have direction. So just keep doing what you're doing because the leadership has an overview of the whole battlefield here and is going to keep this thing going, keep it together. So that's the picture of where Moshe is there with his arms up like that. So after that incident, there was a memorial altar that was put up, and that memorial name was given. You see, the creator of heaven and earth has a number of memorial names based on what? Things that he has done. And in this case, there in Exodus 17:15, it's recorded that that memorial name is Adonai Nisi. And that's the same word that we have in our passage we're looking at here today of Genesis 22, of testing. But that's very interesting because in this case, that's a derivation of that word Nes, Nun Samek again. And in this case, it's talking about my banner, or the Lord is my banner, or my banner is the Lord. Number of different ways you can put that. So thus you have this picture of not just an emblem or a sign, but testing can be a sign for not only yourself, but also for whom? Other people. That testing, that going through this incredible struggle can be a sign for other people and an emblem for other people down hundreds of years later with that. And we see later on in Israel's history, it was recorded there in Numbers 21, where we have the account of the fiery serpents, where mainly it's just poisonous serpents that come into the camp. Because one of the things that's revealed, when we talk about sight, vision, it's revealed that as Israel was moving between Mitzrayim, between Egypt and the land of rest, that in between that time, the various desert creatures were not coming into the camp. And that one of the things we see in Numbers 21, where it talks about the Lord, because of the what? Grumbling, the complaining, the attacking, the leadership of the Lord, losing trust in the leadership of the Lord and of Moshe, the Lord said, okay, you think you can do it yourself? There, the protection is lifted. And so now all of the creatures there that desert dwellers have to deal with and have a problem with all the time, and you know, even in some jungle areas and such where they've got poisonous snakes and spiders and scorpions, etc. That's just a part of life in desert climates and even some jungle climates. Well, that protection you have against all that is now lifted, and they come in force. And you have a lot of people that were dying from snake bites. So thus, this serpent was put up on a pole. And it's a very interesting way that that is phrased, as the Nachash Nachoshet. Because Nachash can be translated as serpent, or it can be translated as copper, something red. Very, very interesting, that play on words that you have there in the language, because that play on words, that's the Nachash, is after what? Dam, blood. What is blood? Blood is red. So the reddish creature of the reddish is after the red. And where is the red? Dam is in Adam. We'll call him Adam, because he is the man from Adama, or the dirt. So we have this message that's given down here, is that this kingdom of the Nachash is after the lifeblood, after the life of humanity, and is going to attack where humanity is at its weakest, where it thinks that humanity is at its weakest. And that's in Numbers 21:9, it's talked about that Moshe then put this Nachash Nechoshet up on a pole, and that would become a Ness, that the serpent was on the Ness, the sign, the emblem, and that would be a rallying point for all who were dying from the snake bite, that they would turn, look, there we are, looking again. They would look towards the Ness, towards this banner, the emblem, where the Nachash Nechoshet, the bronze serpent, was on it. And thus, heaven would grant salvation. It would grant the saving from your death that was coming from the snake bites. So thus we see later on in the Gospels, in John chapter 3, verses 14 and 15, Yeshua referred to this very, very thing of that Ness as a prophetic banner for himself. Just as the Akedah was a symbol of something else, that the Lord would be seen. In John chapter 3, verses 14 and 15, as Moshe lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so the Son of Man be lifted up, so that whoever believes in him have eternal life. Now, as we think back to the Nachash Nechoshet, the bronze serpent on the Ness, the pole, what was that type of belief that the people had who were actually saved from the snake bites? Is that like, oh yeah, I know that that thing is on that pole over there. Yeah, it's over there. Okay. Yeah, it's over there. I see it. No, that's not belief, as you see talked about here in Scripture. That's not the kind of trust you're talking about here. But that's oftentimes how people treat belief. It's like, yeah, I kind of know. Yeah, I got that Messiah over there. Yeah, I know. I got a Bible on my shelf. It's over there. Yeah, it's over there. I got a picture of the Ten Commandments. It's on my wall. You know, I've got a sticker on the back of my car. It's got a fish on it. See? Yeah. So I got that. It's kind of like an amulet, sort of. It's on there and kind of maybe it keeps the paint on or something like that, or maybe keeps people from tailgating me for something or other. But is that the kind of trust that you actually see demonstrated here in Numbers 21? That's not the kind of trust whatsoever. Because in the account there with the bronze serpent, if they treated the situation like that, what would happen to them? Dead. They'd be dead. The snakes would have gotten them. They would all be dead. Yet, this snake is still out attacking, biting us on a daily basis. So, I mean, do we treat these attacks of the serpent as been the adversary of humanity from the very beginning the same way? Just kind of, oh, yeah, it's over there. Yeah, maybe. Maybe I'll use it. Maybe I won't. Maybe I'll depend upon it. Maybe I won't. Well, a number of people have, and going back to this account in Genesis 22, a number of people over the centuries have noted that the Holy One in the opening verses of Genesis 22 is trying to limit or narrow down Avraham and where the attention was actually going for where this deliverance was going to come. Because there in verse 2, it says, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Yitzhak. So the first one, your son, well, I can say, well, which one? And your only son. Well, what do you mean, the only son? He's got two of them, at least. And whom you love? Well, We just saw in Genesis 21 and going all the way back to 16 there about how much that's the love for both Ishmael and then later Yitzhak. So definitely a lot of love for both of them. But then narrowing it down even further for Yitzhak, because that was the son who was going to be the promised one. And his willingness, both of them, both Avraham and Yitzhak, to both say, Hineni, here I am. I'm ready to step up for what's going on here. Ready to be proven, to be tried. So let's get back to this idea of trying again, where we have the Hebrew word of nasa, which is variously translated as test, try, prove, tempt, assay, put to the proof, put to the test. And the derivative word that we get from nasa is masa, which should be a name that we recognize. Remember, masa and meribah, that shows up a lot in Scripture, especially there in Psalm 95, and then riffed on a whole lot in Hebrews chapter 3. And it all goes back to that account that we were seeing there earlier about Exodus 17, about who is it that we actually trust and who is it that we're actually nisa, contending with. So thus you have you talk about Israel putting the Lord to the test. And so you also have Adonai is now testing nasa of Avraham. And it's interesting to note here from the theological word book of the Old Testament, the notes, in most contexts, nasa has the idea of testing or proving the quality of something, someone or something, often through adversity or hardship. The rendering of tempt used frequently by the authorized version and the authorized standard version generally means prove, test, put to the test, rather than the current English idea of entice to do wrong. So that's one of those cases where when language changes, you can lose some in just translation of your own language from a previous culture time period to even your modern culture. Because what we often talk about with tempting today is not originally what the word tempt meant. Meant the idea of testing, proving, and improving, and by that, improving. Because tempt is when we get the idea in modern times, we think tempt is what? To lead away from, which we'll see is a completely different idea than what you get throughout the Bible. So let's look on even further with this. That's in a passage that we reference a lot because it has a lot to do with the counsel that we have on this interaction between faith or trust and proving or testing. Testing that trust is in James chapter 1. And in here, the Apostle Yaakov is really bringing together a whole lot from the Tanakh or the Hebrew scriptures about what it means to really put the Torah into action. So it's not just some sort of theoretical idea out there, not something like a placard that's sitting on a wall somewhere. It is actually something that's a part of your life and getting into a lot of situations that we would care not to really think about or say hineni to, that say, here am I, I'm stepping up, I'm going to take action. So, and it's also interesting that the Greek word, it uses the Greek word of perazo, which the Septuagint or the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures is, that's what it translates nasa with. So in this passage we're seeing in James chapter 1, it's using the equivalent Greek word to what we see used to translate that word nasa that we saw back in Genesis chapter 22. So when you're seeing in Genesis 22, and it's using this word nasa, and it's translated as to test, the idea, the equivalent idea in exploration is being seen in James chapter 1. So let's take a look at that. So James chapter 1, starting in verse 2. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Continuing on, verse 5. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But he must ask in faith without any doubting, for the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For that man ought not to expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. And continuing on there in verse 9. But the brother of humble circumstances is to glory in his high position, and the rich man is to glory in his humiliation, because like flowering grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and its flower falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. So too the rich man in the midst of his pursuits will fade away. And this is something you see throughout Scripture. In fact, there's a whole book that's basically talks about these verses here of 9 through 11 in James chapter 1. We call that the book of Qohelet or Ecclesiastes. And that was the idea of, hey, I pursued richness, I pursued pleasure, I pursued all this stuff. And what did it actually get in the end? In fact, interestingly enough, what word do you think shows up a whole lot in the book of Qohelet or Ecclesiastes? Nasa, test. I tested pleasure. I tested wealth. I tested pursuing violence, and I tested this. What is he doing? He's trying it out to see if it actually holds up and if it actually is something that brings you meaning, purpose. It brings you to shalom or to completeness, well-being. And what did he find? Again and again and again, it was havel. It was vanity. It was like wind blowing. It was here 1 minute, gone. So he nasad a whole lot of different things over time and found them all to be just wind. So continuing on back here in James chapter 1 in verse 12. Blessed is a man who perseveres under trial, for once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to him who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. And you're like, at this point, you're probably thinking, well, this sounds like a completely circular argument here. That this, you should be glad when you're facing these kinds of trials, because this idea of tempted, that's the same word, the parazo. It's the same word throughout this. You're seeing different English words used here, but it's the same Greek word that's being used throughout this, parazo, which is what we get back, it's nasa, back in Genesis 22, that idea of trying to put it under not just a quiz, pop quiz, hope I trip you up, get you to fail. No, this is inspecting it to see what, to make it better, which is why you see at the beginning part of James chapter 1 that the purpose of this is to do what? Perseverance, endurance, so that when you are to the end of it, you are, to put it in Hebrew terms, you are tamim, you are complete, not missing anything. That you are reaching a point of shalom at the end of it. No matter what kind of chaos is going around you, you are in shalom. So that should be getting you back to this idea of when you see, I'm being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. So can he be tested to see if evil is good? No, because remember back in the garden, there were two trees, tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and bad or evil. So the one who created everything, why does he need to try out evil? Doesn't it? Because he knows where that road leads. And he's been trying to, since the beginning of humanity, to say, no, don't go that way. There is a better way. You don't have to live like this. So there is not the idea of testing trying to lead away to some sort of nefarious end. So continuing on here in James chapter 1 and verse 14. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. So thus you can see what this testing is really trying to get toward. But it's saying when each one is tempted, he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. So this idea of testing things, what often happens when we are facing a trial with something and we may want to give up? We say, no, this is too hard. This is too hard. You know, for somebody who's actually trying to recover out of something, even if they know that what they were enslaved with before was like, as it talks about in Proverbs, like a dog returning to his own vomit. Even if they remember that, yeah, that's what that life was like, they're like, at least I know what that was like. there's even comfort in the agony of it. It's odd, but we can find comfort even in agony. In compromising values and such. So when we are facing some sort of a trial, we may want to just say, to give up and just say, why keep fighting against this? Just go on back to the life that I lived before. And so we may just forget why it is that we left. We see that throughout Scripture again. Remember, it seems kind of weird. We keep seeing throughout the Exodus, again and again, they were dreaming about what? The leeks, and dreaming about the flesh and all the meat and stuff that they used to have back in Mitzrayim, the house of bondage. Forgot about the bondage, but they remembered the things that were useful on it. And each one of us faces that in a similar sort of way with each one of our strongholds that we're delivered from. We can remember the good parts about it. And addicts can remember, you know, the hit, the high. But they forget what? The down, the fall, the crash, the pain that it causes other people around them, the chaos that it creates in your life, being dragged away by this. So as we continue on in James chapter 1, verse 16, but do not be deceived. And this is very interesting because this word that is under the hood there of planao, and there in Greek, means being led to wander. So do not be led astray or led to wander, my beloved brethren. Every good thing given and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. In the exercise of his will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, so that we would be a kind of first fruits among his creatures. So first fruits is a reference to what? Oh, resurrection. Okay. But when you talk about first fruits is reference to agriculturally, it is a beginning part of your harvest, beginning part of the harvest. We even have a part, one of the appointed times of the Lord is related to the first fruits of the harvest. But a harvest comes at the end of a season, growing season. And growing season involves what from the farmer? Sowing and reaping and all kinds of things that go into the agricultural cycle. And certain crops require a whole lot more attention than other crops. So in other words, that the farmer and the whole farming operation to bring forth the first fruits has been very attentive at what has been going on in, we call it cultivation, and bringing this along toward its end. Its end is the harvest. You know, because what good is it? Those people who have the vineyard there across the street, they work everything together. They work hard in the pruning. They work hard in, you know, they removing the leaves to give more sunshine and putting more leaves on to give more shade in various times of the year. And if it's too dry, applying irrigation and such, and then give up in July and then go to some Hawaii or something and spend the rest of the summer. Yeah. All of that, it may come to naught. Because what if you're off in Hawaii and you look down on your phone and go, uh-oh, there's now a 115-degree heat spike out there. Who's going to be there to turn on the irrigation? Because they're going to need water because, you know, the vines are going to try to counteract all the heat that's happening here and start basically sweating. As the leaves actually sweat a lot during hot times to try to dissipate the heat. It's an amazing system that the Lord created on heat control, just automatic systems within plants and such. Well, you know, if the people that are supposed to be tending the vineyard just take off and leave it, well, where is your first fruits going to come from? Yeah. So thus, that's the appeal here from the Apostle Yaakov is saying, hey, what the Lord is started, remember, it was in other places, he who began a good work in you will bring it forward to completion in Messiah Yeshua. So thus, hey, you know, the Lord is here with you throughout the whole thing. He sees what's going on. So don't take your eyes off of the one who's taking you and your crop and the crop of the entire world, of the harvest that the Lord is doing on the earth of people. Don't take your eyes off of it. Along the way, get distracted by the ways that we used to live and the way we used to do things. You know, remember the days where we were a proverbial prune orchard over there instead of a vineyard. And I go, well, I want to go back to being a prune orchard. Okay. Problem is there's no prune trees over there anymore. It's now a vineyard. So you may live in the days when you were a prune tree, but there's no longer a prune orchard over there anymore. It's now a vineyard. So living your life like a prune tree when you're in the midst of a vineyard, how does that work? Nonsensical. And that's often how we go through life, living our lives back in our proverbial prune tree days, when the Lord has uprooted that orchard and has now planted a vineyard. And we're now a part of a vine. Yet we want to be individual trees again. So thus, when you see, as we kind of round things out here, that the Genesis 22, as it goes through all the passages we looked at here today, that heaven is progressively gave Abraham the vision to see the promise of his seed, who would bless all nations, that promise would happen regardless of his attempts to make it happen. And he tried all kinds of different ways to make this happen. And we see kind of a reflection on that in capping things off here in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 17 through 19. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Yitzhak, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, "In Yitzhak your descendants will be called." He considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead, from which he was also received him back as a type. So there we have a picture, and the Hebrews chapter 11 also talks about this kind of a vision forward, that's of this city without foundations, whose architect and builder is God. He's given a picture that what is going on right now is more than just the deals that you're doing with this particular Avimelech, or this particular Paro, or this particular force here, or dealing with Sodom and Gomorrah and all of those things. That what heaven is doing is far larger than these little incidents or scenes here along. There is something, this trajectory, that heaven is directing the world back toward, to not just to have it be like a vineyard that is left in the middle of the growing season to just do whatever and maybe not ever come to being whatsoever, but rather this is something that heaven is directing from the beginning to actually produce a crop, produce us, all of those called into the kingdom of God. And as we kind of look toward that with Moriah, a lot of people have debated over time as to what place Moriah is. And you see kind of a noted there in the writings about David was building his house and fortress there with Mount Moriah. So you get this picture, okay, Mount Moriah and Jerusalem, and became to be Mount Zion. You're talking about the same general place there of Jerusalem, of Jerusalem. But it's interesting that a lot of people have wondered, well, it seems to be Moriah often how Hebrew words work is that you will have a noun that's built upon verbs. And oftentimes you'll have the Hebrew letter mem, which we call, it's transliterated as an M, so it's got an M sound on it, gets tagged onto the front of a verb of some sort, and it becomes a, means like the place of this, the place of this happening. So people have wondered that Moriah could be a combination of the place of Ra'ah, or to see, or it could be the place of Yara, which means to fear. And we've talked about this before with the passages that talk about the fear of the Lord is the beginning of what? Knowledge, wisdom, understanding. And how in Hebrew, that's Yara, which means to fear, and Yira, which means to see, or he will see, they're spelled exactly the same in Hebrew. So thus, you get kind of almost a play on words here between fear and he will see. This picture that the Lord will see what goes on earth, and thus we should have reverence for heaven because nothing escapes his view, even though we may want to think that the things that we do here on earth are completely out of the purview of the creator of heaven and earth. No, we're just kidding ourselves on that. But we see that Moriah was the place where Avraham bound Yitzhak in anticipation of offering him up as a burnt offering to God. It was the same place where the temple would eventually be built and where the sacrifices would be offered on the altar. So Yitzhak is taken to be the very place where the city of Yerushalayim would one day witness the sacrifice of another son. And indeed, Adonai would be seen centuries later in the appearance of the Lamb on Mount Moriah.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.